Welcome to the Journal.ie's The Explainer, where every week we take a deep dive into a different news story. I'm Sinead O'Carroll, and in a special series of European elections episodes, we'll be helping you to prepare for your June vote. And so this week, we're going right back to basics. What exactly is the European Union and what does it do? When we embarked on this project, EU 2024 Explained, we said we wanted to help voters in Ireland really understand the power, or lack of power perhaps, that the MEPs they vote for will have. We've been holding focus groups, carrying out extensive polling, writing explainers, visiting Brussels and Strasbourg, and canvassing readers for what questions they have for EU experts. And we keep coming back to this. What exactly is the EU anyway? How does it work? What does it do? And does it matter to us at all? But it is actually a massive part of our lives, sometimes unseen, but a lot of people are understandably then a bit lost when it comes to how it all actually functions. We're going to start from there, and over four episodes look at the past, present and future of Ireland's relationship with the EU. To start us off, I'm delighted to introduce our guest. Honestly, when I read this man's CV, we could not have got a better expert for the first episode. John O'Brennan is a professor at the Department of Sociology at Maynooth University and director of the Maynooth Centre for European and Eurasian Studies, where his work focuses on the European Union institutions and politics, as well as Ireland's relationship with the European Union. Welcome, John, and thanks in advance for answering all of my technical and maybe not so technical questions over the next few minutes.
Thanks, Sinead.
Let's get into it without ignoring the elephant in the room. EU politics is just sometimes, it feels boring, it can be boring. Why do some people think that? Why do some people switch off when they start hearing about EU councils or they start watching it on the news?
Yeah, I think the main reason is that it's very abstract and it's distant. Brussels and Strasbourg, literally and physically and everything else, seems a world away from most people's lives. And yet it's become more and more important over the last 50 plus years of Irish membership as the EU has taken on more and more responsibility. So there's a paradox there. On the one hand, if we look at our legislation, probably 50% of it now comes from the European Union in some shape or form. But for most people, Brussels is still a faraway place of which we care little, and we only really talk about it during referendums, perhaps during a European election campaign, although very often even that doesn't happen. In 2014, you might remember that that campaign was completely dominated by water charges rather than any European issue. So Brussels remains kind of unloved and remote, and a lot of that, I think, has to do with the fact that it's not just over there that it happens, but it's also very technocratic. A lot of what the EU does is around regulation and the regulation of markets in particular. And that stuff necessarily can be legalistic, can be very jargon heavy. And I think that has a kind of off-putting effect. And we know from our own referendums that people really struggle to understand what's in the treaties and when those treaties are up for revisions, what the nature of those revisions are. So knowledge and information are really crucial. And that brings me to one final point, which is about the media. I think it's great that you're doing this kind of series. And I've read in the journal pieces that you've done on Europe, and they're really very, very useful indeed. But the simple fact is that there are fewer journalists working in Brussels nowadays than was the case 25 years ago.
That's interesting, isn't it? So we saw it as big and bureaucratic and technocratic, and then it takes on more responsibility. So then inevitably gets bigger, more bureaucratic, more technocratic. But the media industry is getting smaller, but we could do another podcast on that. The money just isn't there anymore. So yeah, so both those things are happening at the one time. So obviously we're trying to write that a little bit so people kind of ahead of June will understand the nature of the European Union and how it all works. So let's start from there, because there's the institutions and even some of the words I find like around the EU, when people start talking about institutions and the names, that can even, I think, kind of make people glaze over. So let's just go through what the institutions are. Let's look at the European Council. What's its main function? Who sits on it? How does it work?
Well, the European Council consists of the heads of state and government, and it is the main political actor. As you would expect, these are the governments that represent each of the member states. I suppose this is where the EU is at its most familiar, because when the Taoiseach goes to Brussels, he or she will meet their counterparts from the other 26 member states in the European Council. So the main task that it has is to provide the political direction, the kind of overarching direction for the EU at any given period in time.
And how do they decide like what to focus on, or like where do their conversations start?
Well, a lot of that depends on what's going on outside of the EU. So foreign policy will take up a lot of time. Over the last few years, it's been Gaza and Ukraine in particular that have occupied attention, and immigration as well, because immigration is one of the absolute key issues right across the 27 member states. So that sort of filters up to the political level. But the European Council doesn't actually do any legislative work. That's for the Council of Ministers in the European Parliament, which we'll go on to discuss. So it's important to remember that the European Council is there as the most important overarching political body to kind of guide the work of the EU over a five-year period of time.
Okay, so the European Council decides on the direction and what we should be doing as member states led by the leaders of those states.
And very often, I would just to give you an example, if something comes onto the agenda, say, for example, artificial intelligence, it's become a matter of acute importance all over the world in recent years. And typically, if the leaders in the Council think that the EU should move on something, it will then request the European Commission to scope out that particular area and to develop it into a legislative proposal. But that proposal will not be considered by the European Council. Once the Commission develops it, it will be over to the Council of Ministers and the European Parliament to do the legislating if they can agree on it. So the Council kind of comes up with the idea very often, and it's the other institutions that have to put it into practice.
So the first of those institutions then is the European Commission. Who is the European Commission? Who makes it up? And what do they do then?
Well, the European Commission has been around from the very beginning of the EU in the early 1950s. It is an absolutely unique organization. And we should say the EU itself, there's never been anything like it in history, where 27 sovereign states have come together voluntarily to cooperate in given areas of activity, and with the overall objective ensuring that peace prevails amongst them. So when the Commission was formed, the reason it was unique was that it was pooling the sovereignty of the then six member states, the original six member states in the 1950s. So instead of France and Germany each having control over their own coal and steel industries, they put it under this independent management. And that's very important for people to remember, I think, that the European Commission is there to represent the European interest. The member states, Ireland and the other 26, they go to Brussels to bargain with each other and negotiate on different things. But the Commission is there as a kind of referee. It provides the policy proposals that get the legislative process going, and that is its main role under the treaties. But it's also referred to as the guardian of the EU treaties. So it's supposed to ensure that whatever the member states agree to do, that they actually honour what has been agreed in the Council. And that means sometimes that the Commission will come after a particular member state. Ireland, for example, has a pretty poor record in implementing environmental legislation, if we go back over decades. And in that kind of situation where we have failed to implement a directive that has been agreed, the Commission will come after us and say, you are not fulfilling your obligations. This is what you've got to do to rectify the matter. And if all of that fails and we still don't come into compliance, then the Commission can ask the Court of Justice to intervene and to make a decision. So it has a very important role, I would say, Sinead, both in terms of coming up with policy proposals and doing so crucially on behalf of all of the 27 member states collectively.
Would the Commission ever come up with something by themselves, or are they bound to only come up with proposals and policies based on what the European Council, who are the leaders of each member state, have told them?
No, the Commission is a completely independent body. And it is charged under the treaties with maintaining that independence, all the better so that it doesn't favor particular member states on particular issues. But your question is a very interesting one. It's about the way in which policy proposals come onto the agenda. And there can be a whole variety of different ways. Sometimes it's because 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 member states are asking for something to be done about something, and they will ask the Commission to scope it out. Sometimes it might be the European Parliament, where there's a big majority in favor of a particular policy proposal being developed. Sometimes it's because lobby groups, powerful lobby groups like the farmers, for example, will lobby the European Commission, and they will ask for a particular measure to be considered, or, as has happened recently, have put pressure on the Commission and on other institutions to kind of back away from legislative proposals that they had already made. So it's a very important body. It's interesting that nowadays Brussels has more lobbyists than Washington, D.C. That'll be interesting to people who watched House of Cards and other such series, that literally every single area of economic activity, that companies will have their representatives in Brussels, all kinds of regional organizations, and they're all seeking to influence the policy process, whether it's the Commission, the Council, or the European Parliament. But the Commission is really important because no proposal can come onto the agenda of the Council and Parliament without the Commission tabling it. So it's absolutely crucial to everything.
So then how do you become a commissioner? Who are the commissioners of the European Union?
Well, firstly, every member state is entitled to one commissioner. And usually what happens is the prime minister in that particular member state will nominate a person. Now, all of this will take place after the European Parliament elections. And the selection of the commission is supposed to reflect the outcome of the elections. So you're supposed to have balance in the people that eventually become part of the commission. But once the Irish government makes a nomination, that nomination then will go to the president of the European Commission. So the president of the commission will be appointed first, and the nominations will come in from each of the member states. The president will usually accept whatever person has been nominated by the member state, but not always. Now, the reason that's important is that the commission itself, once all those nominations are accepted by the commission president, it has to go before a vote of the European Parliament. And the commissioners themselves have to go individually to the European Parliament, and they have to get a grilling over half a day or sometimes a day on that particular sectoral area. And we have seen over the last 20 years an increasing number of these nominated people have been rejected. So their nominations have been withdrawn, sometimes because of financial impropriety, you know, in their own member state, sometimes because they just weren't competent enough and the European Parliament made it clear that it would not approve the commission. But the commissioners themselves are not approved one by one by the Parliament. The Parliament only has the right to accept or reject the commission as a body. So at the end of the process, the Parliament will vote on whether or not to accept all of the commissioners together as one commission.
Where does the main power lie then? So we've kind of touched on, and we'll get into what the European Parliament does as well, but is the real power with the European Council? Is it with the Commission, or is it with the Parliament?
Well, in the early days of the EU, undoubtedly all of the power lay with the Council, the Council of Ministers, and that means the member states. So the Commission was very unique in being an independent body and what we call a supranational or a collectivist body there to manage the EU interest. But its main job was to come up with policy proposals that would be considered by the Council of Ministers, that is, by the member states. The European Parliament had absolutely zero power in those early days of the Union. And it was only in 1979 that the first elections to the Parliament took place. So we're now moving into the 10th elections in June of this year. But even in the 1980s, the parliament really wasn't much of a player politically. It was the council that really dominated. And slowly, decade by decade, the European Parliament has acquired more and more authority so that today we can say that the council and the parliament are co-equals. We call them co-legislators because it is the two institutions together that have the task of taking whatever proposal comes from the Commission and making amendments to it and coming to agreement on it. So the legislation, when it's proposed, will go before the Council and the European Parliament, and they will then have to come to an agreement before that legislation can be formally ratified. So when we talk about power, it's a system of dispersed power. I would argue that the Council is still probably the most important institution, but the Parliament now has a lot of authority, not just in making legislation with the Council, but also in, for example, ratifying the EU budget. Again, many years ago, the Parliament had no input into the budget at all. That was entirely a matter for the Member States. The Commission would make a proposal and then the Member States would consider it. But the Parliament now has virtually joint authority there as well.
Because that's interesting, because a lot of people, when they talk or criticize the European Union, they'll talk about the unelected commissioners, because as you mentioned, they're appointees of prime ministers of the state. But they are often former parliamentarians from their own countries.
Yeah.
But now coming into June, if the power of the parliament is growing, that shows that the power of our vote is also growing, because if there's more influence in the parliament, then each parliamentarian can have more influence.
Absolutely. One other thing that's really important, just on that question of whether this is democratic or not, I said earlier that the parliament has to vote on the commission once it is put together. But the appointment of the commission president is slightly different. What happens there is that the European Council will meet in June after the elections, and they will have to come up with a single candidate that they will put to the parliament, and the parliament then has to vote on that candidate. And within the council, this has to be done by qualified majority voting, or it can be done unanimously. For the last 25 years or so, it's the centre-right, the European People's Party, of which Fine Gael is a member, that's had the most number of MEPs. So that means they have the right to nominate the Commission President. But when that happens, it goes into the European Council. And, you know, it becomes a kind of Game of Thrones type marathon. But once the European Council does that, it's not enough. That nominated person then has got to go to the European Parliament and has got to be elected by a majority of its component members. So you could argue that it is very democratic in that the people we elect in June will be themselves voting on who is to become president of the commission. And let's remember that all of the governments that nominate a candidate for the commission, they also have a mandate within each of their national jurisdictions, just like the Irish government does, the Polish government does, the Slovene government, and so on. But I do want to go back to your question, which is a really good one. It's about this disconnect between the power that the parliament has on the one hand, and to go back to your very first question, why the parliament isn't really very well known, like the EU institutions aren't very well known. There's a real paradox here that if we go back to 1979, to the very first direct elections, every subsequent election that was held saw the turnout in the elections fall. The low point came in 2014, when only less than 43% of people around the EU turned out to vote. And the paradox there is that the turnout rate keeps going down, but the power of the parliament had kept creeping up all the time. But that was reversed in 2019, when the turnout went up by about 6%. It went over 50% for the first time in a very long time. So maybe people are finally beginning to understand that the parliament is a player, and that who we elect in June really does matter for a whole variety of reasons.
We've moved on a little bit and you've explained loads, but just to kind of, for people who may be voting for the first time or may be interested in the European Parliament for the first time, just to kind of tell them what exactly it looks like and what kind of layout happens every day, what kind of work happens every day there.
Well, once candidates are elected, so in Ireland, this time we have 14 seats. We have one more than last time. So once those people are elected and go to Brussels, what they usually do is to join one of seven different political groupings in the parliament. So instead of having political parties, you couldn't really organize the parliament like that. For example, the European People's Party, the centre-right grouping, it has 84 different parties that are members of it. So they go into these family groups or political groupings. There are seven of them. Broadly, the centre-right, the centre-left, groups further to the left. There's a green group. There's a group called Renew Europe, which is a centrist liberal grouping, which Fianna Fáil is part of and President Macron's party are part of. So that would be the first thing for MEPs. They will join the relevant political grouping. And so, you know, for Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, it's pretty easy. They know what groups they're going to be in. But for other successful candidates like independents, they have to make a choice about whether they will join one group or other. And those
you absolutely have to have a group, do you? You can't be an independent would be aware of here in Ireland.
There's also it's called the NI group. And there are about 50, as far as I can recall, about 50 MEPs that are part of that group. Though on a proportionate basis, there aren't as many of them as there are in Ireland. And part of the reason for this is the way the parliament does its business. Those groupings, the bigger they are, the more entitled they will be to have positions on important committees. And this is one very big difference between the European Parliament and national parliaments, just compared to our Dáil, for example. All of the really important business of the parliament is conducted through its committees. Now, our committees sometimes do important work as well, but there are quite a few of them that really don't do very much at all. They do a lot of political grandstanding sometimes for a whole variety of reasons. But all of the legislative work is done in the parliament through its committees. So to become the chair of a committee, and especially the really important committees, is really very prized. And that person can expect to have very significant power. I mean, I've thought for a long time, for example, that if you're an Irish MEP and you get onto the Agriculture Committee, you probably have as much power as the Irish Minister for Agriculture. Now, if you think about that, it's a very big statement. And
that is a bold statement, yeah.
Absolutely. But it's because over a very long period, the biggest part of the EU budget was spent on agriculture. Now, that has reduced a lot. But even today, 30% of the EU budget is spent on agriculture. So to get onto that committee, and if you become a senior kind of member of that committee over time, then you are certainly somebody who's going to wield a lot of influence. So I think that's the big, big difference, that the committees are the workhorses of the parliament. And when the proposals come through from the commission, they will first go through the relevant committee. And that's a kind of specialist committee, depending on each sector. And it will then eventually come to the plenary, the total membership of the parliament, potentially to be voted on. But very often the parliament will be guided by the reports coming out of the committee in terms of the position that it actually takes. So the committees are hugely important.
Okay, so I think we're kind of clear on the role of the parliament, the role of the commission. Can we just kind of go back a little bit and look at the European Council versus the Council of the EU? And if you just can explain the differences between the two.
Well, if we go back to the original blueprint of the European Community, it was in the 1950s, there was no European Council. The European Council only came along in 1977. And it was basically because the French were deeply suspicious of the European Commission. They were from the beginning. And it was for decades an informal body. It didn't have any real legal authority under the treaties, but that changed via the Lisbon Treaty. And I what the French wanted, I think, was to try and ensure that the kind of political direction of the EU could remain under the control of governments. But I think the European Council first really came into its own in 2008 during the financial crisis. And you remember the years that followed, we had crisis after crisis in Ireland and Greece, huge number of summit meetings being called and so forth. And that was where Angela Merkel and President Sarkozy of France, I think they were really determined that the European Council should steer things where Eurozone reform was concerned. COVID, I think, was kind of similar, that, you know, governments decided that they had to work together and the European Council was the vehicle to do it. But the day-to-day work is done by the Council of the EU. And that is the main legislative organ of the European Union, along with the Parliament. So back in the early days, again, it was just the Council. But the addition of the European Council was really to give, to drive the kind of longer term strategic political direction of the EU, while the Council of the EU consists of the ministers sent by each of the national governments in their relevant portfolio areas. So, for example, Helen McEntee will represent Ireland, because she's the Minister for Justice here, at the those relevant meetings of ministers of the Interior and Justice, her equivalents throughout the EU. The same goes for agriculture, the same goes for environment. The Council has a number of different formations. I think it's 11 or 12 in total. And that's where the ministers will go very regularly to meet each other and to help shape legislation as it's developing. One very important role here to point to as well, which gets zero attention, and that is that if you look at the machinery of the Council of the EU, there's a very important role for our ambassadors. So every member state sends an ambassador to Brussels. They're not called ambassadors, they're called permanent representatives. So Ireland has, we don't have an embassy in Brussels, we have what's called a permanent representation. And we have a permanent representative. And that body is collectively known as COREPER. And it really is absolutely crucial to everything. 80% of what is decided in the Council of Ministers is decided by the ambassadors at COREPER level. So what they do is they just leave the important or divisive things, the top 20% of things, to the ministers. So when the ministers meet each other in Brussels, very often they're only signing off on things that the ambassadors have already agreed on, or where there is particular disagreement on some issues that the ambassadors have not been able to solve. So I think that's one thing that isn't widely appreciated in Ireland and elsewhere, that if you look under the bonnet of the Council, our diplomats play an absolutely crucial role in shaping everything.
If you could go back in time, I would advise all of them to name their bodies different things so that it would be more straightforward for people. It feels like a silly thing to say, but I think that's part of how it's difficult to even do an episode like this.
Yeah, it's an affliction. And the addiction in Brussels to not just to jargon, but to acronyms is just unbelievable. Like, I've been reading EU documents for almost 30 years, and sometimes I just lose the will to live, to be quite honest. You get down in the weeds so much.
I think we've avoided jargon mostly, but one bit of jargon that I did want to ask about is a trilogue. Can you just tell us what a trilogue is and what happens during it and what's the outcome of them?
Where you have a disagreement between the Council and Parliament. So supposing they've been debating a particular piece of legislation for the last 2 years, they still cannot agree on it. The trilogue is there to try and facilitate solving that problem. So it will see the Commission coming in as kind of as mediator to try and bridge the gaps where they exist between the Council and the Parliament. And the aim is that they get a settled definition of whatever it is that can be agreed upon and can be enacted into law. This never used to be an issue when the council on its own used to decide on legislation. Once the parliament became a more and more important actor, and to the point where it became the equal of the council, that's where you had the potential for difficulties, and that's where the trialogue comes in. It's kind of problem solving.
Who has the final sign off for European legislation? So we kind of know that that idea of dispersed power,
yeah.
But you know, when something is going to be enacted and all the countries are going to have to follow it, or else they risk, you know, a slap on the wrist from the commission or, yeah, you know, the courts then at that stage, what's the actual sign-off procedure?
Well, you start with the commission. It makes the proposal. The proposal is then considered by the council and the parliament. And if they agree, it will then be enacted. So either in the form of directives or regulations. So whatever form it takes, it has then got to go back into every national setting. So every member state will have to give legal sanction domestically to whatever has been agreed. So we will usually do it in the form of statutes that will be passed by the Dáil. The Commission then has a role in monitoring whether or not the legislation that was agreed in Brussels is actually being implemented in each of the 27 different member states. And very often, the member states will not actually implement what has been agreed around the table in Brussels. And there can be good reasons sometimes. Environmental legislation, for example, can be very costly to implement. And for that reason, governments might only partially implement what's been agreed. And if at that point, and say we're 2 or 3 years on now from the legislation being enacted, if a member state is still not in compliance, the Commission may be forced to go to the Court of Justice. So to answer your question, the Court of Justice is the ultimate arbiter. It has the power, for example, to impose financial sanctions on member states. And usually it's a long drawn out process, and the Commission will give the member state every chance to rectify the problem. But in many instances, we do end up with cases going to the court. And given that the EU, most of what it does is about market regulation, there has to be a court there, a Supreme Court, if you like, that has the ultimate power to decide, to ensure that whatever the member states have agreed to do, that they actually do it.
John, thanks so much for coming in and explaining all that to us. I definitely feel more educated about the institutions and a bit more prepared for my own vote in June. And I hope our listeners do as well. But we have 3 more episodes in the series. So if anyone does have questions and they want to get in touch, please just give us an email at news@thejournal.ie with any questions or comments that you may have about the European Union or your vote in June. And we will do our best to answer them over the next few episodes. Thanks so much again, John.
Thanks very much, Sinead.
Thank you for listening to The Explainer, and a big thank you to John for joining me. This episode of The Explainer was brought to you by senior producer Nikki Ryan. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider supporting us so we can continue to make more just like this one. There's a couple of things you can do. Head to thejournal.ie/contribute to become a monthly subscriber or make a one-off donation. You can also leave us a review and rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. It's a great way to make sure other people will find us, listen, and love it as well. This work was co-funded by Journal Media and a grant programme from the European Parliament. Any opinions or conclusions expressed in this work are the guests' own. The European Parliament has no involvement in, nor responsibility for, the editorial content published by the project. Thanks for listening, and catch you next time.